Welcome to the Honest Bathcast. I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Webb, and with me are Dixie Cochran.
Hi.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Yeah, whatever.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess we're here. We're not here for the rest of the episode, though.
If you're sensing some animosity in this Bathcast episode, the reason why is because I'm going to be talking a lot during this episode.
Exclusively, even.
By myself, alone in a room. Because what this episode's about is during the course of creating Pirates of Pugmire, I recorded a design.
You recorded yourself alone in your room, like a weirdo.
I recorded myself alone in a room by myself, a weirdo, talking about the book I was working on
for days and days. You know, the most disappointing thing about this design diary, to really amp it up, you know, the most disappointing thing about it is that there's no Captain's Log supplemental. There's no, I've now been 3 days without water. And no one has responded to my signal flares. It's definitely more of a design diary than a dramatic one. So
the thing is, he recorded it by himself, so if he wanted to make you a liar, he could go back and add those pieces now.
Oh, he could, couldn't he? He doesn't have much time, but I think Eddie is a man of many skills.
Well, I mean, during a previous episode, you did mention slide whistles, and I was half tempted to go back and add them in. I did decide against this. Considering you added that to the John Burke episode, I decided that one perhaps was enough.
I did. I used retroactive editing magic.
Magic.
To add a sound effect.
Did you really? I have to go listen to that then.
Yes, I did. Rather than me going, oop, I actually put a sound effect in. That's how my editing skills have advanced in the 50-odd episodes since we started this.
I mean, for what it's worth, we made Eddie edit all of them for the first 6 months, 8 months we were doing this.
Right.
Yeah. And then Eddie kind of went, you know, guys, this is actually a lot of work. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm sorry. I guess I can edit stuff too.
And to be fair, it was all me to not mention, by the way, it's a lot of work for like 6 to 8 months.
We owe Eddie.
We
owe him a lot. Yes. Yeah. No, maybe not.
My brief amount of praise is squashed back under.
So I will say I listened to this actually a few weeks ago because we had a mix up where I think me and Matthew both thought we were recording this intro and outro. Mm-hmm. And we both went and listened to it. It is really interesting, but also like every image I had of listening to you talk was that classic like movie, like there's like one dimly lit lamp on a desk piled with papers and you've got your head in your hand and you're just like, it's day 7 of working on Pirates of Pugmire. I just can't crack this case. Like, I don't know why, but that's like that's
noir.
The mental image. Yeah, that is the mental image that my brain conjured.
Cigarette
even
burning
though...
out between two fingers.
Yeah,
right. Light between the slats across my face. You know.
Yeah. Ooh, we could make it a little industrial and an oversized fan in the wall behind you, slowly rotating through which the light is for some inexplicable reason shining.
Yeah, you've like got like a you know disheveled button down and like a vest and like a really loose tie on. There's a hat on a hat rack by the door.
Yeah,
5 cups of coffee all around the desk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we need to write a noir game. That is what is clear from this. Never
all
mind.
Chronicles
Pirates
of Darkness
of
is a noir game.
Gordon Rose Bailey, and she's not wrong. Wait a minute, while we're writing that game, we'll go right into the design diary for Pirates of Pugmire. It's Wednesday, August 22nd, and actually we just launched the Dystopia Rising Kickstarter, and so far it's going well, but that's not actually what I'm here to talk about today. I just really started finally working on the outline for Pirates of Pugmire, and I thought it might be interesting to record kind of the process as I'm working on it. So prior to this, I had sent some pitches to Rich for what we could do for what I'd been calling kind of wave 2 of the Realms of Pugmire. Wave 1 was Pugmire, Monarchy Zamao and the attending products from the Stretch Goals. Fetch Quest is kind of sort of part of Wave 1 as well. It's also kind of sort of its own separate thing. Don't look too deeply into it. It's not an elaborate plan. Really, the Wave 2 denominator is more along the lines of, okay, if I was going to end the Realms of Pugmire lines, what books do I need to get out to be satisfied with that? So it's really what the intent was. Like, here are the books that I really feel like we need to do before, and after those are done, if things are still doing great, then we can look at the next set of books. But if we had to say, cool, okay, nope, that was great, we're done, we're happy with those, then we could end on a satisfied note. And so one of those was Pirates of Pugmire, and that has actually been on our radar for quite some time. I kicked around the pirate idea pretty early on because I thought it was a natural progression. Here's the realm of Pugmire, or sorry, here's the kingdom of Pugmire, here's the Monarchy of Zamao, and then what's over the sea? And when you think about seafaring, pirates kind of come naturally to mind. So I had talked about it probably a couple of years ago at this point. It's now 2018. It's probably 2016 is when I first started kicking the idea around with Rich. And as we codified things, as things moved along, it kept kind of floating to the top going, yep, that's really cool. Yeah, it's really cool. So we did these round of pitches. That was the book that Rich and I both were like, no, let's start with this one. And for those who don't know, the pitch is basically just really a page of here's what I think needs to be in the book, here's why I think the book's cool, here's why I think fans will dig it, here's why I think it'll be good for us financially. And one of the things that came out of that is originally I had pitched it a bit more like a gazetteer. Like, here's what the world looks like. And Rich and I chatted about that. He had some concerns because location books generally don't do well financially. There are certain exceptions, obviously, and certain iconic location books to point to and say, look, that did well. But the fact that there are a handful of those and then a wide variety of other books that people barely remember indicates, you know, they're the exception that proves the rule. Location books generally don't do well. So I kind of wanted to reframe that. And so I settled on the idea of turning it into a chronicle book where it's a mini chronicle that kind of covers a few different adventures. And then all of the stuff that goes around those seafaring adventures. So, you know, it's a logical way to have new enemies, new character creation options, rules for seafaring, rules for navigating, all that stuff. All your piratical bits make sense if it's here's a bunch of adventures that involve seafaring pirates, and then here's all the things you do to play seafaring pirates. So when I was starting to kind of break those down, lizards and birds made sense to put into those books. Because one thing, as I was about the third of the way through Mao, I realized is that we couldn't keep doing core rule books for every species. And I wasn't really planning to do that. I had vaguely idea that maybe mice and rats would get a third core book. But as we were kind of working on Mao, then certainly after Kickstarter of Mao, it's like, you know, it did well. I'm very happy with how the Mao Kickstarter did. But it was clear that there's a market force where subsequent books sometimes do 50 to 70% less. I'm sorry, a step down to 70 or 50% of what the previous book did. So there's a kind of steady decline in those. And we're not quite seeing that, but certainly there is a downward shift from Pugmire. And also it just made the branding a little bit harder. And plus cats and dogs, it's a very kind of natural binary. So there's lots of reasons why, but we said, okay, so Frostwind books, we're going to do species inside of another support book. And so with that decision, we decided, you know, lizards and birds are going to be in there. So we got the pitch done. We signed off on it. I got a little bit of thinking done, mostly research before Gen Con. Lots of things like reading well-known pirate novels, Treasure Island, Captain Blood, watching movies, watching cartoons, because I wanted to get not only historical piracy, but also pop culture piracy. So I tried to weight things like Pirates of the Caribbean and Pirates of Darkwater at the same level as you know, think books that were written to emulate historical piracy. And it wasn't really a systemic thing. It's more kind of pick books up, read through. I've read like the Prose of Lutra, which was a Redwall book that involved some seafaring bits. It was pirates explicitly. And they kind of just sampled a lot from a lot of different things. You know, read Seventh Sea role-playing game, which I actually not picked up until I started working on this. I looked at, there's an episode of DuckTales recently that had air pirates. So kind of just all, and I was, I just jot down notes as I got there. That's a cool idea. That's a cool scene. That's a cool moment I want to think about. Then I went to the zoo and looked at some birds and reptiles and kind of, okay, what's cool about them? What's jumping out at me? So that's kind of what I do at that stage. When I'm doing at that research brainstorming stage, it's just a lot of me jotting down random notes into a document. So now I'm at the outline stage, and where I'm at is basically just kind of trying to pull all of these random bits. Here are the random bits we talked about in the pitch. Here are the random bits I've done some research wise. How do I pull those together? And I don't have an answer for some of those yet. I'm very early stages. And that's kind of why I wanted to start documenting this, is because I wanted to kind of get a sense of where, how my brain evolves and how things work with this. Like right now, I have a what I call research spike. I'm looking into ways we can do bird arms and to a certain degree, lizard arms. Because Dixie kind of put me on the spot on one of our podcasts and said, so how do bird arms work? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. And it's become kind of a joking meme as people sending me images and whatnot. But actually, there's been some decent community discussion about the point. That's what I love about having this kind of open discourse. Where we talk about stuff on the podcast. We talk about stuff at Gen Con. We talk about stuff on the blog. Is because sometimes ideas will pop up and say, oh, that's actually pretty cool. Let's dig into that. So I had a couple things. A couple people sent me images for reference. And I'm thinking that through. But I don't have an answer yet. Right now, I'm really at the stage of, what do I do? How do I pull these ideas together? I mean, I just have a big... I had a sheet of bullet points, and I've just been kind of lumping them under the chapters that I had specced out in the script or in the pitch. So it's okay. This is all character creation stuff. This is all new rule stuff. This is some ideas for the adventures. And there's a lot of character creation stuff and not a lot of adventure stuff. So, I mean, I have to kind of start to find the difference between those two. So that's where I'm at. And I'm about to go on vacation in a couple of days. So, there's a lot of more wrapping up, more urgent things. And again, we just started a new Kickstarter. So I don't know when's the next time I'm really going to sit down and think through the outline stuff, possibly early September. But when I have another moment, I'll try to record another diary and we'll see how that goes. It's Tuesday, September 4th. I just got back from vacation yesterday. Even though it was Labor Day, I still did a little bit of work getting caught up on email because I took a 11-day break. And so Pirates of Pugmire is back on my radar. And during that time, actually, Rich sent me some concept art, some concept sketches. And this is something that Rich and I have been doing for Pugmire specifically. Not all projects get this kind of pass, but it's something that's interesting about Pugmire because Rich has a very strong opinion about what the look should be, but also some of that is discovering what that look should be. We found that with Pugmire and with Mal both, that it made sense for Rich to kind of do some sketches at an early stage, so that way we could then give the writers we hire some concrete guidelines and also some sketches and concept pieces to work from. And for Pugmire, there's a lot more conceptual stuff because it was completely new. We had no idea what it was. And a lot of the things that we talked about during the times where Rich was doing sketches actually helped redefine the world. So like how armor looks and how taverns work, because we had to figure out how the, you know, should they be normal mugs, but how does that fit with snouts and noses? I actually get into a great conversation about the different styles where we settle on bowls and skins. Those are very common things, but also that there was a point where one of the previous pug queens was in charge, that the mugs were actually in fashion because it didn't impede their snouts as much as other dogs. But again, then the other dogs became kind of outraged by the implied insult and things went back to the more common mugs and things. So there's a lot of world building that comes from these art discussions, particularly when you're making a whole new game, or in this case, a new extension of the game. Pirates of Pugmire is not just take the original games, slap a coat of pirate paint on it, and move forward. I'm still haven't made much progress in the outline since my last journal because I've been on vacation. But I've been doing a lot of thinking about that, and so part of that conversation was Richie asking me what should the clothes look like. And so I got a lot of pieces from cartoons, from actual pirates, from pirate costumes, because I didn't, again, this isn't historical base. We're not basing this off of real world history. We're basing this off of pop culture understanding of pirates. So I tried to look at Halloween costumes just as much as actual clothing from the time period. And one of the things that we settled on early on was that high-ranking dogs and cats as a species all wear fairly more ornates. You know, they wear the feathered caps, they wear the brocade coats, whereas the scurvy sea dogs and perhaps the very poor cats and also lizards in degree, other species, tend to have more of the head handkerchiefs, you know, and earrings kind of aesthetic. So during my break, Rich actually sent me some pieces to kind of get a sense of what the clothing could look like at first. So we have I have a sketch of a pug captain. He's got a nice big coat with a kind of a épée, French épée. And big earring in one ear, and then behind him is a more kind of his crew, and so there's a pity, and it looks like a Sherman Shepherd maybe, and a poodle, very angry looking poodle, and they're wearing different kind of clothes, and they have different kinds of weapons like axes and kind of the curved swords, not quite scimitar, but the curved blade that has a striped back. And then another piece that kind of gives a closer look at some of those crew members to get a sense of what their top-to-bottom clothing looks like. And then also a picture of the cats. Like, one of the cat has an eye patch, but also has kind of the more neat Spanish armor full plate. So it gives a kind of balance of, you got the piratical eye patch, but also so kind of like almost Three Musketeers-esque armor look. And then his shipmates has kind of the cloth cap, with a slight, with a puffy jacket and the sleeves. So it's a little lower class than the cat, but still higher class than the other dogs we'd seen. So it's interesting because, you know, it helps to kind of figure out what the edges of the box are. And then the other sketches he sent me were specifically of a parrot captain with a parrot on his shoulder, something I had mentioned a lot at Gen Con, so he actually drew that for me, which is hilarious. But there's three different sketches of it, specifically because the other piece, as I think I've mentioned, is we're trying to figure out how arms work. And so basically he took one sketch of a parrot and then did three different versions of that parrot sketch, showing three different arms, you know, with parrots with just arms and no wings at all, parrots with arms and separate wings in the back, or parrots with arms that go along the wings. And so this allows me to kind of think about the different possibilities, what are the pros and cons of each of those approaches, and then we're going to have a meeting later on to kind of talk about all of these pieces and also other stuff that may come up, the questions he has in terms of he discovered as the course of writing and drawing these. So it's a great exploration phase, and this is part that a lot of people think of when they think about designing games, designing worlds, is it's all, the sky's the limit, we could do anything. And it is fun, don't get me wrong. I mean, I genuinely enjoy this phase of creation. But one of the things that I have to think of as I'm looking at these pieces is, how does this inform the game design? Like, for example, one of the things that I already knew I had to address, but these pieces reminded me, is that if wings are involved, I have to think about if characters have flight or not. And then how will the mechanics of that work? You know, what does a flying character look like in the Pugmire system? And the other piece is that because pirates are involved, you know, one of the pieces has characters of a wide variety of economic scope, let's say. You know, some characters are very, very poor, some characters a little more rich, at least in their attire, which leads to the point that pirates, a lot of the aesthetic of pirates is about treasure, and the core Pugmire system does not mechanically have discrete, you know, 55 gold pieces, 25 silver pieces. We don't have that kind of economy. It's a very narrative economy. So how does that impact, you know, with the source book, do we have optional rules for adding in an economy, and what do those look like, and how does that change just the way the game plays? So it's not just about figuring out the art and making sure that the artists have good pieces. It's also a bit of how does this, there's a lot of overlap between world design and art, at least at the, in this style, at least in the way Rich and I are working on this. And again, it's not a common approach. A lot of the projects I work on, it's much more I'm writing the words to somebody else's art, or someone's doing art to my words. So it's a nice change of pace to kind of have the kind of overlap thing, because I do think it makes the product stronger. I think it's one of the things people talk about with Pugmire specifically, is that not only is the art exciting, but it helps to sell the world, and the world then reinforces what's going on in the art. Pretty consistently I see people, they'll see pieces of art going up for an upcoming Pugmire project, and we'll speculate what it means for the world as a result. So I find that exciting. So it's not a common thing in the kind of work I do, especially with a lot of licensed stuff. Usually I'm inheriting a lot, both art and words. So it's exciting to kind of have this level of synergy and discussion. And I know that this is something that Rich has worked on previous games. When you first created Scion, when you first created Trinity Continuum with the rest of the White Wolf guys, there was a lot of this early sketching, early research to kind of get a sense of what the look and feel of. So I know it's common for him, but it's fun for me to be able to have that process and do it. So I have these cool sketches in. I'm going to have a meeting with Rich at some point this week. I'm also, hopefully, once I get through my backlog of work for my vacation, dive back into the outline today. My main goal with the outline in the next few days is just to kind of take all the scattered thoughts I have and flesh them out. Yes, last time I recorded this, it was mainly just getting it all kind of organized. And I've done that. I got a sense of how it all fits together. And I've already realized that some of the chapter breakdowns I had, I need to combine a couple of chapters and break out on some other chapters, which is pretty common. We have the pitches, and it's initially just kind of, here's what I think we need to cover. And then we start looking at the amount of material. I was like, okay, well, I need to give more to this and less to that. So I need to move those pieces around. We start fleshing them out, thinking through all of the concerns, thinking through all the rules I need to make. And that's going to be the big problem. Is that I think this step's going to be just mostly get everything roughed out with notes of, okay, I need to design what character creation for lizards and birds are going to look like. I need to rough out what the adventures need to cover to connect to each other. I need to insert economic rules here, that kind of stuff. So I think the stage is mostly just figuring out the pieces I still need, get everything else sorted out so I know the pieces I need to design, and then I can separately spend time actually designing those pieces, which hopefully maybe I'll get to in another design diary. It's Tuesday, October 9th. So since last time I recorded, the outline finished. I sent it to Rich. We had some discussions about it. He had relatively minor points, just kind of idea suggestions. And also during that time, he sent even more concept art. We have like 9 or 10 pieces now. He's really into this, which is great. It really, really helps, as I mentioned last time. But the outline's done. I'm pretty happy with it. Rich is pretty happy with it. We sent it to some potential interested writers. I had so many people who were interested in working on this project. It's an interesting mix of people. Veterans I have are Elissa Rich. She worked on Monarchies of Mao, so she's an established writer on the franchise. Dixie Cochran, she's edited most every Pugmire, Realms of Pugmire book, but she actually wants to stretch her wings a little bit and get more writing experience. So it'll be an interesting challenge. She's going to be coming in kind of as a experienced IP person, but not necessarily experienced writer. So be curious to see how that works out. Danielle Lazon. I've worked with her a number of times. It's her first time working on Pugmire, but she was the line developer for 7th Sea. So not only do I like working with her, but also her experience from that will be really well, really good. Jason, I'm going to pronounce his bad name, but Inkzalkis. I'm sorry, Jason. Hopefully I'll get it right after I talk to you directly. But he's a new-to-me writer. He's worked for Onyx Path on a couple of projects, but he's been very excited. I contacted him several times about working on a Pugmire project. I thought this might be the good time to try him out. And Travis Legg, he has been very, very vocal supporter of Canis Minor, and has been finding some good success at both Canis Minor and also the DM's Guild. So he definitely knows the 5e space very well. Again, big fan of Pugmire. So this is the first time he's worked for me, and also only the second time he's worked for Onyx Path. He also did the DM screen for Scarlet Lands. So this will be the second time ever he's worked for Onyx Path. So it's a really nice blend of experienced people, new people, and also experienced people in a new space. I always try to go for a bit of a mix. I don't like to have the same voices all the time. That's why some of the people like David Bounds isn't on this project. It's because while I love working with people that I'm comfortable with, I can't grow as a designer if I'm not constantly exposing myself to new voices, and particularly diverse voices. So yeah, that's kind of my own process, is just to, you know, get people, new people, onto it and thinking about it. And everyone brings new things to the table, and it helps keep a property fresh, particularly when something like this, where Pirates of Pugmire is not a reinvention per se, but certainly is taking the existing material and doing new things with it. So last time we talked, I mentioned I had a couple of concerns, and one of them I think I've solved is that the treasure concern. I decided, rather than worrying about the monetary value at all, I just focused on the quest. So now treasure is basically a kind of wonder, for those of you who know Pugmire. But there's a legend associated with it, a legendary, you know, covenants, if you will. Or providence, I mean. You know, the idea that this is not just a plus one sword. This is the sword that One-Eyed Pete buried when he was being captured by zombie pirateers, and he had to abandon his sword so that he could escape. That's the kind of stuff. And being able to tell people the story of how you got the treasure, and also what came before with the treasure, that's a big piece of it. Separately, also, the idea that treasure sometimes implies conditions like cursed or charmed or possessed. So that sometimes taking up a treasure isn't always a good thing. Something can happen to you. So really playing less with the fact that in Pirates movies, a chest of gold is naturally parted out. It's just more of the chest of gold has a reason why it's important. You know, picking up a piece of gold curses you and turns you into a ghost or what have you. So that's kind of where I'm going with that right now. So one thing I'm doing differently with this project also is what I've been jokingly calling the Dawkins method. Matthew Dawkins, the last two projects I've written for him on, has required the team get together on a Skype or Google Hangouts to talk over the projects so everyone's on the same page. And for most of the projects I work on, I don't see why that's necessary. I can see why it could help with team building, certainly. I've always seen I haven't seen the value in it. But it is challenging to schedule 7 people at the same time, particularly freelancers, because a lot of people who do freelance and tabletop role-playing games have their own day job. So we're looking at nights and weekends, and if they're scattered across time zones to boot, it could be very tricky. But in this case, I do think it was important because there was a lot of interconnectivity. In particular, because we have lizards and birds in this, people have to be on the same page as to what those are going to look like. Waterdog Port is going to be a big part of the book, and so the adventures that feature Waterdog Port have to line up with the person writing the Waterdog Port section, and the Waterdog Port section has to have lizards and birds integrated into that description. So there's a lot of things like that that are constantly interconnected. So getting a call to kind of talk through everything, make sure everyone knows what's required of them, I think will be important, because I have worked on projects in the past where people aren't necessarily talking with each other. The big chunk of time I spent was getting the character creation for Lizards and Birds right. I wanted to make sure that they had enough flavor and diversity and interest, but also this isn't going to be a rule book centered around them, so I have to lean on which book, you know, how much of stuff can I offset to the Pugmire or Mao books. And also separately, because of the nature of this project, I don't know if the reader's going to have access to just Pugmire, just Monarchies and Mao, or both. So there's going to be a particularly tricky challenge on that. But that said, both Lizards and Birds have three different groups, and they're going to have what I'm calling NACs. NACs can be, going forward, the generic term for tricks or secrets. Dogs will still have tricks, cats will have secrets, everybody else will just have NACs. That way, because making a new term for each one is going to be increasingly confusing. Callings, there's going to be six new callings in the book. Two of them are going to be for dogs, two are going to be for cats, one's going to be for lizards, and one's going to be for birds. Lizards and birds can take any of the other four callings as well, so it's technically speaking dogs, lizards, birds, cats, lizards, birds. But just for clarity, it's there are two that assume you have the Pugmire book, there are two that assume you have the Mao book, and then two that you only one of those books and this book to be able to use. So if, say, if you only have the Mao book, then you can use the two cat ones or the lizard one or the two cat ones or the bird one, depending on, you know, how it works. And that's a little confusing, I know. So that's definitely something that the book hopefully will spend some time to explain how you can pull these out. But there's some interesting concepts here. Actually, two of them base around a new concept, which is firearms, gunpowder weapons. That was an interesting one because it's something I knew early on I wanted to use, and Rich and I talked a lot about it because it's such a part of the aesthetic. But traditionally, when gunpowder weapons are introduced into a fantasy world, it involves a step up. It's power creep, and then it's always the why wasn't this ever found before? And Rich really keyed on the fantastic idea that loud noises scare dogs and cats. So I've created a concept called Gunpowder Panic. Which is, if you use a gunpowder weapon, you have to roll, make a saving throw, and if you fail, then you get the scared condition and the deaf condition. So you can't hear and you're freaked out. So it's not a usable weapon in war long term unless you're really trained in it. So there are two callings, one cat, one dog one, that allows you to actually use gunpowder weapons. So we'll see how that plays out. All of this is just the ideas I've had in the outline. The writers are going to kick it around. We're going to actually have a meeting next week to talk things through. Maybe I'll try to record before or after that meeting. But we're going to have our chat to talk things through. And the writers are already kicking ideas around, both in the outline and in the Slack. So all of this is subject to change. It's entirely possible I may gut something. Unlikely, but it is possible. I may just say, okay, this thing, we're completely redoing it. So we'll see how it evolves. But I'm really excited about where it's going, and I think it's going to be very, very cool. It is Monday, October 22nd. Last week, I did the chat with the writing team for Pirates of Pugmire, and it went really well. Longer than I expected. I thought it would only take about an hour. It took an hour and a half. But part of that was because we were getting some good conversation going. So for context, I've never really done this before as a developer, although I've been on the receiving end as a writer for a few of these calls. It's something I've seen some developers doing recently and wanted to try out. The idea is that the outline's well and good, but particularly for projects that require a lot of coordination and collaboration between writers on certain sections, the idea is to get everyone together on in this case, Google Hangout, and talk through the outline and just kind of, you know, here's what I'm thinking, here's what's going on. So it gave them a couple of weeks to kind of think things through, come up with some ideas, give them a call, and then start sharing all that information. And like I said, it went really well. There were a couple of things that came out of that I don't think would have normally come out of just doing it through outline. Like, you know, here's how we tweak some of the words and then how some things look and sound. Also, like, okay, questions like how much was I invested in a particular design or system? or a certain world detail. In some cases, I was like, no, I really want this one. In the case, I was like, no, actually, let's go ahead and see what happens there. It's definitely something I think I'll do again, but also because you're trying to coordinate, in this case, 7 people's schedules, many of which are in different time zones, largely East Coast based. So it was relatively easy to do that. But for some projects, I had people all over the world on them, and it's a lot harder to get people on in the call. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's like it's really, really useful when we can do it, but also, like in this case, it took 2 weeks just to find a slot that we could all talk on. So it's not a card I can play often, let's say. But it's certainly something that I want to continue to keep my back of my head and think through, because having worked in video games so long, the idea of the team dynamic and making sure everyone's communicating and working towards the same goal is so important in a good video game design. So to bring that to tabletop RPGs and applying that ideology and that thought process has been interesting. It's been enlightening. It's something I've been working on for almost 2 years now. I'm excited. Now is kind of the awkward stage where a couple of people have really strong ideas. They want to start talking things through. And other people are like, I don't have time to engage with this yet. So I'm trying to kind of stay abreast of it. But generally, I'm letting them kind of go until the end of December. That's when deadlines are due. So it's going to be kind of a gap in this recording for a while, I think, unless something comes up. That's a note. But this is kind of how the process works when you have several projects is, you know, okay, I'm going to start Pirates of Pugmire going, and then that's going to go. Well, in this case, I'm working on, like, I just finished up Dystopia Rising, sent out the editing, I'm right in the middle of a development pass on Trinity Aberrant. And this is, I think, so again, you have these big chunks of time. Try to manage the schedule so that way they fall into the parts where other people have gone off and doing something for large chunks of time. So you're writing on the next project while I'm developing the first project. And then once that goes off to layout and whatever, and I don't have to engage with it as often, then, you know, right around the time the second projects come in, so I start developing and redlining those drafts. And then once those red lines are out, then I start the next project. And that's, so you kind of have this, bucket brigade, the idea of there's always another piece going out, another piece coming in. That's kind of the high-level process. But from a Pirates of Pugmire-specific process, I'm excited. I mean, it's my baby. It's definitely a project that I have very strong feelings for and very strong opinions on. And clearly, that creative direction, other people seem to have value in it. So that's exciting and nice. But also, this is, again, I've said before, the first time I really been truly collaborative at this stage. Everything else is usually I kind of come and say, this is how it's going to go. I just need you to fill in the gaps. This is much more, I'm not entirely sure how it's going to go. And I'm letting people come in and be a little more kind of involved in the collaborative process. So it's exciting because it's helping me. I feel like I'm breaking out of a rut. I feel like I'm getting new, fresh ideas, which is the whole point of having not only a writing team, but a diverse writing team, is to get voices and opinions and thoughts that you wouldn't normally think of. And just generally, you know, I'm excited about what things happen. Everyone I mentioned the idea to has been really into the concept. I think it's a very strong potential product. So much so that I'm always worried when they're like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. It's like, okay, but will the next book also sound amazing? I've been lucky in the sense that just about every time I do something post-Pugmire, it's like, that sounds cool too, and that sounds cool too. So people are excited and engaged by it. And Pirates certainly seems to be in that wheelhouse. But, you know, I have other books I want to do, and I don't know if people are going to be as excited or effusive in their praise. So it's going to be an interesting long-term experience. But for now, not worried about that. Right now, I'm just worried about Pirates. Writing team, again, seems happy, and they're all got some really good ideas, and they're starting to really talk and share, hey, you could do this and I could do this, and let's talk things through. So we'll see how it continues to go on. It is December 20th, right before the end of 2018. And we've hit our first real road bump with Pirates of Pugmire. One of the writers had to drop out pretty close to the end of the first draft phase. Luckily, not too close. I had originally first drafts due at the end of the 31st of December. And certainly I've had plenty of writers contact me the day before, the day of, the day after, weeks after, to say, oh, wow, by the way, I can't do this. So it seems like it's not a lot of time, but actually it is the perfect amount of time for this writer to have dropped out, because I still have a day or two left before I go on vacation. I was able to reach out to potentially another writer. He's checking his availability. And I was able to give us an extension to the other writers. Normally, in these kinds of cases, I kind of have to see what's going on from a design perspective. And I talked before, this is such an integrated book that I can't really let one writer work in isolation while the other writer sent drafts in. That's something I've done on other projects. Aberrant, for example, there was enough separate pieces that could have some of those come in and we can start talking and redlining those while we're waiting for other drafts, other chapters to come in. But this one requires so much connection with each other. I just couldn't do that. And with the holidays, I couldn't just give, here's a couple of weeks. So I had to give a pretty meaty extension. So right now it's January 18th. And basically it comes down to next week, I'm on holiday vacation. Most people are. The week after that is going to be New Year's, so I was going to be ramping up from that. The week after that, I'm flying out to Midwinter for our summit and the Midwinter convention. And then after that, I'm going to be recovering from all of that. So I realized I couldn't realistically even engage on it until at least, the third week of January. So giving the team the extension, if I'm not going to be doing anything useful during that time, I might as well give them the extra time, make absolutely sure they have everything done. So I just sent the email out to the team to let them know what's going on. And this is part of the gig. I mean, I don't want this to sound like it's, oh my God, everything's terrible. It's always frustrating when stuff doesn't go to plan, but it almost never does. When you're making a production schedule for really any kind of game project, video games run into this too, you try to plan as best you can, but at the end of the day, something's going to go wrong, and you have to account for that. Luckily, I had built in a little bit of buffer into the schedule, but because, like I said, the holidays and my travel schedule, that buffer's now just gone. We've just got to move forward with it as best we can. So I really can't take any more serious bumps without it becoming then my time I have to eat up. So how this kind of works is like if I do get a writer that just says, I can't do it, and if I can't comfortably get another person on board to pick up that material, then I have to do it. And the time it would take me to do it is, I assume that another person would take twice as long. And it's not because I'm better than them. It's because I have to explain it to them. They have to research. They have to talk to the people on the team. They have to think through what they want to do with it. And then they have to write it. Whereas I don't need to have all those steps. But at the same time, if I'm just doing it, then there's other projects that are not getting forward momentum. I have so much other stuff on my plate. If I'm working on Pirates of Pugmire, Aberrant's not moving forward. Legend Lore's not moving forward. Dystopia Rising Evolved's not moving forward. So as a developer, especially when you have lots of projects, you've got to constantly do this push and pull. It's like, is it worth giving someone else extra 2 weeks or whatever to make this happen while I get other stuff done? Or can I carve out enough time out of my schedule to do it myself? So it's not always a simple just pure math. Production's always, you're thinking of can I do things in parallel, simultaneously? Can I have things, another thing starting before another thing finishes? The more I can have stuff overlapping and more people working on things in overlapping stages, then I have more collective productivity, but that's also not a one-for-one thing. The more stuff I have overlapping, also that's more stuff I have to look out for and watch for, which means I'm not directly engaging in any of that stuff. I have to spend a certain amount of time just making sure things aren't colliding or causing problems. So this isn't much of a fun update, it's not talking about, oh, let's talk about cool birds and lizards and pirates. This is much more of a kind of a production thing, but it's worth taking the moment to kind of talk about this. This is why I wanted to jump on here and record as soon as I heard, is because this is the thing that you run into. Like, everyone talks about, oh, you work in games, it must be so much fun. It is. It is a lot of fun. But also these kinds of things happen. And to me, what distinguishes a true professional from an amateur is someone who can get these kinds of roadblocks and find a way around them and still make something. I've seen plenty of extremely talented people never get anything out because production trips them up, logistics trip them up. And it's not an admonishment of them, it's a skill set that everyone has access to. Or they don't have the money or the resources or the network to be able to find people to help them solve these problems. That's one of the reasons why there are, an independent a successful independent RPG is a different scale than a company successful RPG, and that's a different scale from a indie video game, which is a different scale from a AAA studio. The more factors you could put in and get the best use out of, the bigger potentially a project can be. Also means potentially a bigger flop. So it's not risk gets bigger as well as the rewards. So anyway, that's the digression. The point is that this is all part of the gig. This is all part of how it works. I know we've talked about it on the podcast. I know I've talked about it at conventions, but this is a great kind of illustrative example of the fact that these things do happen, and they're not deal breakers. I suspect if things go the way I hope they do, the people who are the fans who are watching, who are excited about Pirates of Pugmire, who are waiting for Kickstarter to happen, this won't even register them. It'll look like, oh, hey, they've been talking about working on it, and now the Kickstarter is ready. And the Kickstarter is ready about the time we anticipate the Kickstarter will be ready. So it's these are kinds of road bumps and problems and things that happen behind the scenes. And to be clear, I'm not talking about the writer who dropped off, but they did it the best possible way they could have. They let me know ahead of time. I was kind of aware that this could potentially be happening, so I already kind of made some backup plans. They finally confirmed today that they couldn't make it. So just the fact of dropping off is not a reason to be angry at a freelancer. Things happen. I've dropped off projects. Sometimes life gets in the way. That is the nature of all work, period, but particularly for a freelancer, it's hard because it sometimes feels like you can never work for someone again because you had to take a moment out for life. So I reassured them that, no harm, no foul. I appreciate them letting me know. They gave me enough time to be able to make change. So definitely for freelancers listening to this, sometimes you got to make that call. But if you have to make that call, make it as early as possible. Let your client know as soon as you can that you can't do it. Because trust me, your client will be much more appreciative of it. There's been plenty of projects where I've been caught, I have to write the missing material, or I've got to find someone to write it on like a week's notice, which is ludicrous. And frankly, a lot of times I end up having to spend what I call hazard pay to pay writers more to do stuff in an extremely short period of time and to do it well. So it's not fun to get that stuff at the last minute. So giving me time to be able to do it is so much better. So anyway, that's the update for today and probably the last update for 2018. So hopefully in about a month, I'll be able to do another recording when I have first drafts in. It is January 31st, 2019, and I have just sent off the red lines for Pirates of Pugmire. As I mentioned in my last kind of design diary, there's a bit of a delay on things, but in the end, it worked out pretty well. The writers had a little extra time to kind of coordinate their drafts a bit more, and that really showed when I was going through the red line process. One thing I do in red lines is that I do kind of like to have it all in one place. So while I gave the extension out, it gave me a chance to kind of get everything together, and it helped me to kind of see things in context. And this project was actually a really good example of why I do that, is because one of the writers actually made a reference to rabbits, which was not something that was agreed to originally. I want this book to really focus on lizards and birds, because those are big, playable, cool races. Perhaps humorously, other writers picked up on that and also started putting references to rabbits in their drafts, so it bred like rabbits. So we end up having this book where it's like, hey, here's two cool species you can play and one that you can't, kind of. I don't think that was the intent. I think it was just, hey, here's a cool thing, and then other people thought, oh, that's also a cool thing. But it's one of those that if it had been a throwaway line in one draft, it may have been fine, but because it showed up in like four different chapters, it ended up being a much bigger perception of what the book was trying to, you know, misperception of what the book was trying to do. So there's definitely a lot of good value in looking at everything next to each other and seeing how it all lines up. It also allowed me to do things like, hey, we talked about this thing earlier, so you don't have to repeat that. And there's like one point where I had suggested some material about the acid sea itself. I had it way at the end of the book, and now that I'm seeing everything, I think I may want to move that chapter up a bit more before the big three core adventures. And there's also just little things like, because there are three adventures now and they are linked, although not directly linked, you can play them in order, but you can also play them in isolation if you want to. But there is kind of a MacGuffin you're trying to follow through the three of them, and so I had to kind of move some pieces around and reassess some things. So I mean, it was definitely a really good process. It's actually the first time I can recall where I've developed a book and everyone got everything in the right formats, everything was documented the right way, they got me all pretty much all the material I needed. Usually there's some amount of me going, okay, I have to reformat it into the right structure and tell people to do things a certain way or not do things a certain way. But this one, actually, all the writers got it, and there actually were writers that I had not worked with before on this, and one writer who actually hasn't worked with Onyx Path at all before. So it was really helpful to have everything in the right format. I probably shaved easily 3 to 4 days off my red lines. So for freelancers who might be listening to this, yes, it is really important that you put things in the Onyx Path style guide. It really does help. And it's one of those things that I've talked a lot about, but I've never had, and I don't recall any anecdotal data where I could actually point to, but now for once I can say, no, actually I had anticipated this taking an extra couple of days that I just didn't have to do because everything was submitted the way I needed it to. It was structured the way I needed it to, and I was able to kind of much more thoroughly look at everything, bam, 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 make my comments in, compile it, and put it together. Another thing I've done for the past couple of projects, which I think has been very helpful for me and for the writers, is what I call overarching red lines. I've seen a couple of other developers do it. I'm not claiming credit for it. But the idea is that if you see a trend across at least two writers, you pull out a bullet point and say, for everybody's benefit, I've noticed this trend. Rabbits was, you know, one of the ones example, but also just other things. Oh, 1 second. Yeah, that was a robocall. Anyway. So, yeah, I mean, being able to kind of notice these trends and spell them out to people, even people who followed that, they may have done so inadvertently. They may have, you know, and not realize that, oh, hey, this is a problem that I need to be aware of. So I did that on Dystopia Rising Evolution, and I've done it on this, and I think it's good to kind of just point out that this is actually a thing I am genuinely concerned about, so please don't introduce this in your rewriting. I think in terms of actually the structure of the book, there's not been a ton changed from the initial conversations we had. There's been some tweaking on things like the ship system. In fact, one thing I did notice is we had a very kind of binary plunder does X, and if you either have plunder or you don't. And so if you've acquired plunder, you now have it, and then you could do certain things with it. But I did notice that in one of the adventures that there's a need for a bit more fine grain. So we have to dig a little bit into how the coin system works and pull that a bit more and how that ties into the overall plunder system. And then separately, the initial design I had, I undershot the amount of words it took for the splats, for the six new callings, and then also anticipated needing to add more spells, because I thought I was going to have spellcasters with all new spell lists. And then after I dug in, turns out that actually one of the spellcasters is able to restructure that into something that's a little bit cooler, more like an alchemist. So it doesn't require a spell list necessarily. And then separately, I could then put one spellcaster remaining, kind of just say, yeah, just pick whichever spell set you want to use. And then so I gave them a few kind of unique spells for them. It's basic spells. So there's a few basic spells they start off with that are different from everybody else's. At least that's different. But then everything else is going to be much more kind of just, pick one of these two. If you have Monarch, use them out. Pick this. If you have Pugmire, take that. But then again, that's pretty typical for the redline process. You have ideas in the outline phase, and you talk them through, and you get different ideas, and you revise the outline based on that. And then you go through the approval phase, and then you get more comments, and you revise the outline based on that. And then you talk to the writers, and then you go through them, and you revise the outline based on that. And then you get the material, and you see even more places where it can change. That's the process. That's how things work. And in this case, it worked really well. We ran into some problems, and I was able to kind of solve those problems with the writing team. So yeah, I'm super excited. I think that this is going to be a great book. I always knew it was going to be really cool, but seeing what the writers brought to the table, it's blowing me away just how great their ideas are. They're definitely thought of a bunch of stuff that I was batting my head against the wall trying to figure out how to make this interesting, and they just almost made it look effortless. So a lot of my comments were really on the levels of, we can make this even cooler, not this is a problem. So yeah. As I was recording these in the process, we did a Onyx Pathcast, and Matthew in the Pathcast mentioned that he wrote a character with a large hat, and he was worried that I was going to redline the hat, to the point where some people actually online were advocating for that, having that idea of what the hat is, but they were advocating for keeping the giant hat. And I'm here to tell you that I have now since found the reference that Matthew is referring to, and the hat has stayed. The hat is not going anywhere. There is, in fact, a character with a big floppy hat, and that character still retains their hat. So if you were worried about that, now you know there are no problems on that end. Now it's off to the writers, and they have until the end of February to get me final drafts, and then I'll go into the development phase, and I'll see how things go from there. It is March 29th, and I just finished the last piece of Pirates of Pugmire. So we have a complete manuscript. Woohoo! So I had gotten in the final drafts about a month ago, and so I spent a couple of weeks just going through, and it was called the development phase. Basically, it is tweaking, revising, making sure things line up. I had a couple things that I had slightly different opinions on near the end, or didn't quite turn out the way I wanted to, but it was just more efficient for me to get that done myself. And during this, Rich Thomas talked with me. He was going to directly art direct Pirates of Pugmire. So we started talking about initial ideas for things like the turtles and the geckos and the birds. These are all things that we haven't really discussed before from a Pugmire art standpoint. I also had to finish up the manuscript and write the interstitial fiction that goes between each of the sections. And all of that is because with Kickstarters, it gets weird catch-22 with art. We need a few pieces of art for the Kickstarter itself to show off, hey, this is what we're going to do. And we need the art pieces to ultimately be something that can go into the book. We don't want to buy art pieces just for the Kickstarter. When the art pieces are something that will actually end up in the book. So I have to come together with a rough idea of some initial art pieces. And they have to be art pieces that both fit with the manuscript and also are compelling from a visual perspective from a Kickstarter. What I'm doing is while I'm finishing up the manuscript, And then, now that I have it done, I just sent it off to Rich so he can then look through, look at the actual structure of the book, the word count, how big it is, and then can tell me what we call the art buy. And it's the, okay, we need to have five half pieces in this chapter, three half pieces in this chapter, a full for this chapter, what have you. And then I'll go through and actually write the proper art notes. So we have this kind of weird structure where I write the initial kind of proto art notes. We talk about roughly what direction we want the piece to go in. Rich has already started contracting a few pieces of art, so we have it ready for the Kickstarter. And then I have to go into the art notes and say, hey, here's the pieces we already talked about. Here's where they'll roughly fit into the book. And by fit in the book, I mean just like it probably goes in this chapter, not actually resembling like a page or a location in the text. But then I fill out the rest of those gaps to make sure that there's a nice even spread of art throughout the book. And then Rich and I will talk about those notes. So, but the actual heavy lifting design of the book is done. At this point, we're really looking at things like playtesting, tweaking things. Like every once in a while, there might be a piece of art that comes in, and we decide that rather than changing the art, the text can actually adapt to accommodate the art piece. Maybe the art piece is cooler, or it's just not worth the hassle, and the text can easily be adjusted to fit. And also, we'll get, you know, playtest feedback. I'll see probably a couple things as it goes to editing or comes back from editing. So, I mean, there's still a lot to do with the book, but at the end of the day, the actual design piece that we're doing with Design Diaries for is over. One thing that's interesting about Pirates of Pugmire specifically, though, before I wrap all these up, is that because it is a book that works for both Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal, we can't use either of those templates, or what we call trade dress. Trade dress is basically the format that books are put in, all of the art like on the edges of the book, the fonts we use for the headers and the fonts we use for body text, the color scheme we use for the books. So like Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal have similar trade dress, but they are distinct. You'll notice on Monarchies of Mal, there's actually some kind of filigree along the edges of the pages, whereas Pugmire, it's a little more clean and clear. We want the cat book to look a little more ornate. Similarly, the cat book in general, the Monarchies of Mal uses a cooler colors, so lots of blues, lots of grays, things that we don't want to give the impression of being quote unquote darker, but we still want a nice colorful look. So we talked about it, and Mike Tenney decided at the time that, you know, we're gonna do a cooler color palette, whereas Pugmire has a warmer color palette, it's a browns and oranges. With Pirates, because we're not doing neither of those, we kind of start from scratch. And so Rich and I have been talking about some ideas about, you know, maybe the layout will be shaken up a little bit. Maybe the logo is going to look different. We've actually already been talked to Meredith Gerber. She's been working on the logo idea for us. So we're going to do some changes and try a different approach to both those books. But I know one thing that we're both pretty on board with is the fact that we want this to look like it fits with us. It's going to be the same print size. You know, it's still going to be that nice kind of digest size we've been doing with all your books. The final word counts for this book was 77,000 and some change words. And for context, both Monarchies of Mal and Pugmire were roughly around 100,000 words. So it's going to be about 75% of the size of the core rulebook. So nice, decent, thick book. But still not overwhelming, not approachable, like, you know, big, ponderous tome. And the goal is that if you have Pugmire or Monarchies of Mal, this book will kind of slide right next to it. It'll fit in there. It'll feel like it's of a piece. If you put them together in the store, they'll all look like they're visually connected. But also, Pirates will kind of stand out a bit more to be a little different. It'll be a different vibe because this is a different thing we're doing here. So I'm really excited. Right now, as I'm recording this, we're probably looking at doing Pugmire around May as a Kickstarter. My goal is that once I've recorded all these, I'll actually edit them together. So I'll play it around the time Kickstarter is actually happening. But for me, right now, the Kickstarter is about a month and a half, 2 months out. So we're doing heavy planning stages. But from start to finish, that's what the design of a book mainly looks like. So it's been cool to kind of record these, to talk about each step as it happens. When I recorded them, I didn't listen to previous recordings. So as I put it all together, there's a chance that I may like snip some bits out. But still, this is a very intimate way of what it's like to build a book project. We've talked a lot about it kind of in bits and pieces, but now I've had a chance to talk through an entire project start to more or less finish. So thank you guys for coming along on this voyage with me through Pirates of Pugmire. And I'm back.
Seamless.
Right, seamless, just...
That was enjoyable. I loved that. I listened to all of it just now.
And not 3 weeks ago, like you just said in the intro.
Yeah. Yeah. This time it was Dixie. So there's always one of us who...
Wait, what did I do?
I dated it. Yeah.
Yeah. I just said that I listened to it early. It's not... He recorded the design diary while he was working on Pirates of Pugmire, which, as people know from the blog, is, like, done. So I didn't think that was dating it too hard.
To be fair, also, I literally dated it every time.
Yeah, that too. That too. And he's got dates all through the thing. It's like Tinder up in this bitch.
Oh my god.
So that's what Pirates of Pugmire is, apparently.
How do you follow that? I can't. I just can't even. Wow.
I don't know where that came from.
So next week for this episode, if all things go well, the Pirates of Pugmire Kickstarter will start. And again, it's we talk a lot about the various projects we work on here, and we love talking about them. But I do feel like this one is a little special to all of us because, I mean, we've mentioned before, this is one of the projects, a few projects all three of us have worked on together. And also, yeah, on top of that, having Rich act as the art director too, it is kind of rare that we have this much working together. And you know, I mean, be clear, Mike Chaney's still also working the project too. So it's a lot of us actually working directly on it. And that's
it's kind of like a little family game. Like it's weird because like, yeah, we all work for Unexpath and we all, you know, work together as in we collaborate here and there. And I talk to Eddie fairly frequently. I talk to Matthew fairly frequently, but like, it is really rare that all of us are on like one project like that. So it does feel kind of special. Mm-hmm. I mean, even one of our very good friends who occasionally does layout and stuff for us did the logo. Yeah. Which was super cool because now I'm like, oh, now Meredith's on this project too. I love her, you know? So like we all have all these people that were like, oh, we got to work with them. It's great. And yeah, I was very, very pleased. I've never gotten to work with Danielle before, you know, like as far as working with her, like writing. So that was super cool.
Yeah. And I mean, also we got some new people on the project too, but I mean, you're right. It was definitely fun to actually say, oh yeah, this is why we do all this stuff. You know, it's fun to actually, you know, work together and collaborate directly as opposed to, like you say, kind of more at a remove.
Yeah.
So I hope it does well, obviously. I'm excited and always I'm nervous before Kickstarters because it's like, you know, I there's evidence that it will be fine. I mean, we funded every Kickstarter Unexpath's ever done. But I was like, well, maybe this is the one, you know, maybe this is the 37th one. People are like, actually, no,
and if we're not holding it against you.
So Pugmire, actually, this is a fun little story. Pugmire was the first book I worked on before we Kickstarted it, where like I had worked on it and then it went to Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So that was the first one I really followed. This is when I was still, you know, freelancing out of my little apartment in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And I was at a party. I was at like a brunch party or something the day it launched or like the day after. Mm-hmm. And just remember kind of like sitting there like drinking champagne, eating some food, and like just watching the numbers explode on the first Pugmire because nobody anticipated it. We're all like, okay, we'll do like a $15,000 goal and maybe, you know, probably fun. Maybe we'll hit like 30 or 40, you right. know, because people like D&D and they like dogs. And I remember just watching it hit like 100 and being like, what? This blew up a little. Like, no, it's not like $1 million Kickstarter, but it's definitely, you know, it was over, it was like 1,000% plus funded.
Yeah.
Or like close, yeah.
It was over 1,000%, almost close to 200,000. In fact, I was recording, I just, before we did this, I recorded the video track, you know, the audio for the video track, I should say. Which, by the way, turns out there's a lot of really good royalty-free pirate music out there, so we're gonna keep that in mind. But
you didn't just go with the "You Are a Pirate" song,
right? No, I would no. I thought about it.
I'm remarkably good at sea shanties. You didn't utilize my talent.
Sing one now.
Oh no.
Anyway, you just recorded the video, and
I was doing the math on all of the money we've raised from the various Kickstarters, and I during the video, because it wasn't about that, I just kept, we made raised over $250,000, but it's actually close to like $330,000, which is wild if you think about that. I mean, it's only three Kickstarters, and you know, I see so many other fantastic, really deserving games that get like, you know, 15, 20, 30K, and they're ecstatic and happy, and I'm sitting there going, wow. I mean, it just, I'm blown away by the generosity of the Pugmire community constantly. So I mean, I know that there are people who are excited about the game out there, and I hope they'll dig it. I know we're gonna talk about it a lot when we're at UK Game Expo. We have little cards to hand out to people, so you can, you know, with cool dog and cat art on it. So I mean, I think it'll be fine, but also still that kind of nerves of like, you know, it's my baby, and what they don't like my baby.
I think
then you kick them.
Yeah, that is.
Someone's
that
like,
is,
I hate your baby. You just kick them.
You throw them overboard and make them walk the plank, as pirates often never did. But
part
no, I think what the keel haul them. We can
there we go.
On.
We didn't put keel hauling in Pirates of Pugmire.
No,
because it's a gruesome, bit... horrible way to die.
That's what this game needs. It's more violence.
Yes, yes, I have advocated for that since day one. No one listened. Thank you. I feel vindicated. Let's string them up from the mainmast. And
super extreme horror version of Pugmire is called Splatter Pug.
Yeah, strap a cat to the prowl.
Is oh it, God!
Anyway. No, don't hurt cats.
Only the nasty cats. Anyway,
I also have scurvy rules too, just for the reference.
One of the things that
can cats and dogs get scurvy?
Wait, I don't know actually. One
sorry,
of the things
go
that,
ahead, Matthew,
that stuck
I'm so
with
sorry.
Me about Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal that tells me anecdotally that it's a success. I mean, I don't see the figures. Is that everyone still talks about them? I mean, we release a lot of games. A lot of companies release a lot of games. The RPG industry is full of new releases every single month. Mm-hmm. And competition is fierce to take the attentions, I guess, of prospective role players, new and established. And Pugmire and Monarchies of Mal is always being talked about. People want to play it. People want to talk about it. And so I think, without trying to put too much of a curse on it, that Pirates of Pugmire will capture that excitement as well. People love pirates, people love dogs, people love cats, and I think even some people love lizards and birds. I certainly hope so.
Yes.
Because
I love burbs.
Yeah, burbs.
Burbs.
Burbs are great.
But yeah, I really enjoyed writing for Pirates of Pugmire as well. That was great fun. One of the most fun stories I have ever written for an RPG, I think.
Yes. I think it's a testament to you to how much Pugmire has touched people, Eddie, in that you've had, you know, a 2 decades-plus long career in this industry. You've worked on Vampire, you've worked on Exalted, you've worked on all this stuff, and everyone thinks of you as the dog guy now.
Right.
Like, everyone is like, oh, it's the Pugmire guy! Pugmire, Pugmire, Pugmire! And it's like, he was well-known for doing White Wolf properties well before Pugmire, but like, if we go to a con or if people are asking us questions on Twitter or whatever, it's almost always Pugmire stuff for you.
It's actually
and I mean, even I associate that with you before I associate like Vampire with you, you know?
Right. Yeah, and it is interesting how it changed. Like, I'm working with a client right now, and you know, I've talked about Pugmire a fair bit with them, and they totally get it. And then during the course of one of the projects, you know, I also brought up Vampire the Masquerade. And like, wait, what? You worked on Vampire the Masquerade too? It's like, yeah, I worked on it for like 5 years. I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea. And it's like, well, thank you, but also really? It's like, you know, but I mean, that's true though. It's like, you know, people love Vampire the Masquerade, but they love the property as a whole, right? With rare exceptions, most people don't think about individual creators. But as you know, with Pugmire, you know, people very much associate with me. With They Came From Beneath the Sea, you know, people very much associate that with Matthews. So, I mean, having the creator-owned games versus the creator-facing games is a different process, different approach. People think about it differently. So it's been really wild. It's definitely been a shift.
But man, if I ever decide to do my own property, I've really got to think about what I want to be known as.
it's important. And you pitched a couple games to me. I think that will do well at some point. But
yeah, we've talked about some stuff. We'll see. Yeah,
We'll see. Keep it in there. But if people wanted to chat with you guys about Pugmire, where would they find you, Dixie?
I don't talk about Pugmire in public.
Okay.
Matthew?
I don't talk about role-playing games in public. They're geeky.
You can find me at Dixie Cyanide on pretty much everything.
So Matthew, you can actually find me on MatthewDawkins.com. And if you want to talk to me about any role-playing games, indeed, there is a handy form on there that allows you to contact me, should you wish it.
He won't answer, though. He's very, 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 very busy. And also, he won't talk about role-playing games in public.
Yes.
Talk to me about something other than RPGs. This bloody industry.
And then people can find me through eddiefate.com or professionally find me at pugsteady.com. You can also find us through theonyxpath.com. We read the blog comments. If you want to contact us on Twitter, you can contact us directly. Or if you want to send us a message, send it through the theonyxpath. This actually came up on Twitter recently. So if you have mails or thoughts or questions to the whole podcast, just send it through the usual onyxpath contact forums. And also, we've been popping up on more streams recently. So wherever you find us, please subscribe, like, leave rating. It really does help to let people know that you like or even dislike the podcast. But any kind of commentary or help, comments or ratings really do help get awareness to it.
Hey, can I plug one more thing that I keep forgetting to plug?
Sure, yeah.
So I know that y'all are going to be at UK Games Expo really soon. I unfortunately can't attend this year. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens in the future. But I will be at Escape Velocity in DC over Memorial Day weekend. I'm doing one panel. It is not about gaming. It is about romance novels. Mm-hmm. So if anybody who knows that I love romance novels and wants to hear me geek out about them, the panel is going to be on Sunday at Escape Velocity. And past that, I'll be wandering around. I have green hair and big cat-eye glasses. I'm very easy to find. So if you like my stuff and you want to come say hi, like, please come say hi. I love talking to people.
Absolutely.
But not about Pugmire.
But not about Pugmire, unless we get, like, a private conference room.
The private
conference. I won't talk about it in public. It's got to be private.
Yeah.
Pugmire is personal for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, because I can't talk about it without just weeping. I'm actually crying right now. I'm really glad that we're remote.
And with that, many worlds, one dog cast.